This is New Guinea, the most fascinating and mysterious island in the world. Because it's located very near to the equator, most two-dimensional world maps based on the Mercator projection warp New Guinea's size and make it appear a lot smaller than it really is. In reality, New Guinea is the second largest island in the world, only behind Greenland, and only just. If you placed Greenland directly over New Guinea, you'd see that they're actually almost the same size, despite our popular perceptions thinking otherwise. Placed over Europe, New Guinea is roughly triple the size of Great Britain and would extend from England and northern France nearly across the continent through Romania to the Black Sea. Or, placed over America, it would stretch from the edge of Long Island in New York State all the way down to Texas and nearly hit the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. New Guinea is a way more enormous place than most outsiders think it is, and it's also a way more unknown place than you probably think it is as well. As much as 80% of New Guinea's territory is covered by dense rainforest, making it the third largest rainforest on the planet behind only the Amazon and Congo rainforests that are on actual continents. Which is why some people have taken to calling the New Guinea rainforest the second Amazon. And if that wasn't enough, New Guinea is also extremely mountainous. The chain of mountains running through the center of the island, known as the New Guinea Highlands, are roughly the same size, elevation, and scale as the Rocky Mountains are in North America. And they feature the highest elevated peaks anywhere between the Himalayas in Asia and the Andes in South America. They are by far the highest and most imposing mountains found on any island in the world. And because of this harsh geography of dense rainforest combined with towering mountains, there is still a ton of territory hidden there that has remained unexplored and uncharted to this very day, deep into the 21st century. And like we're seeing beneath the Amazon right now, there are some incredible new discoveries taking place here right now, and there's a lot of things down there beneath the rainforest canopy that you probably won't expect. Like, for example, glaciers, which probably aren't the first thing that you associate with tropical rainforests in New Guinea. And yet, on the western side of the island that's under the control of Indonesia, exists the increasingly small remnants of ancient glaciers that have been continually shrinking since the start of the Industrial Revolution. The nearby mountain of them, called Puncak Jaya, contains the highest elevated point on the island at 4,884 meters or 6,024 feet above sea level, which is also the highest point on any island in the world. It's high enough that temperatures plummet the further up it you go, which transforms New Guinea's abundant rainfall into snow, which has compacted down the mountain face into the glacier below it for at least the past several thousand years. The New Guinea glaciers are one of only a handful of so-called tropical glaciers that can be found in the world. And they're so remote and not well known that even some Indonesians aren't aware that their country actually contains them. The New Guinea glaciers were first spotted by Westerners in 1623 by a Dutch explorer called Jan Carstens. But his account of snow and glaciers up on a mountain so near to the equator brought him nothing but ridicule from his contemporaries. And hardly anybody believed him for centuries. The existence of the glaciers in New Guinea that he claimed to see weren't verified by Western science for nearly 300 years after Carstens' first observation, when Dutch expeditions between 1909 and 1913 in the early 20th century finally confirmed them. And unfortunately, they probably won't exist for very much longer. We now know that back in 1850, the area of the New Guinea glacier stood at about 19.3 square kilometers, and they were photographed extensively by airplane in 1936. But by 1972, the glacier's area had already shrunk by nearly two-thirds from its 1850 size, and airplane photographs capture the noticeable decline from the 1936 levels. By 2018, the glaciers had shrunk by more than 97% from their 1850 levels, and just half a square kilometer of their area still remained intact. Their rapid decline in our modern times has been captured in satellite images like this one taken in 1988, this one taken in 2017, and this one taken in 2020, showing hardly any trace of them still remaining. The most recent scientific study conducted into the glacier's size was published in March of 2025 and was based on 2024 data. And it showed that just 0.165 square kilometers of the glaciers still survive, a 67% decline just from a few years previously in 2018. If the current decline rate of the glaciers here continue, they're expected to be irreplaceably gone forever by the end of this decade, sometime around 2030. And New Guinea and Indonesia will no longer have any glaciers for the first time in tens of thousands of years. And it won't be the first major geographic alteration that has happened in New Guinea. In fact, back during the last ice age, when sea levels were significantly lower, New Guinea used to be directly connected to Australia by land in a larger continent that we've since called Sahul. Geologically speaking, New Guinea is located on the Australian tectonic plate instead of the Eurasian plate, making it more connected to Australia from a geologic perspective than any of the islands to its west. And why New Guinea is classified as being a part of Oceania rather than Asia. New Guinea and Australia were intermittently connected by land to each other for millions of years, and they only became separated due to rising sea levels around 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, basically seconds ago in geologic time, which is why there is a significant amount of overlap in the animal species between both places today, like their prevalence of marsupials. And why there's some speculation that animals that are currently extinct in Australia might continue existing somewhere in the deep, remote, and unexplored parts of the New Guinea interior. New Guinea is second only to the Amazon for the rate of new species that are still being discovered and described by modern science. Literally thousands of new species have been formally described by researchers in New Guinea just since 2010. Though the vast majority of those new species have been small organisms like plants, insects, and spiders. Larger discoveries of previously unknown or lost mammals are a lot rarer, but from time to time, they do still happen. As recently as 2025, a biologist from the Czech Academy of Sciences captured the first ever photographs of the subalpine woolly rat living in its natural environment in the mountainous New Guinea highlands. A massive, fluffy rodent measuring more than 2.5 feet long and weighing more than 4 pounds that had previously only been known to scientists because of a handful of museum specimens, clearly illustrating how relatively large species in New Guinea can continue remaining elusive in the dense mountainous jungle. Another notable recent example of a major discovery of a large animal like this in New Guinea is the Wandaboy tree kangaroo, a large 20-pound tree-dwelling kangaroo-like marsupial that was discovered on the island in the 1930s, but was then never seen again for decades and eventually classified as extinct, only to suddenly become spotted again by a researcher in 2018 who captured the first ever photograph of one alive and well in the wild. And even more recently came the rediscovery of Edinburgh's long-beaked echidna in New Guinea. This unique-looking echidna was first collected and described in New Guinea in 1961, and was entirely known by just a single specimen of a dead one that happened to be found back then. And it was kept under lock and key for decades in the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. Decades later, after it was found in 1998, researchers realized that it was a wholly unique species of echidna, and it was generally regarded to be extinct, since no other example of one had ever been encountered. That is, until just a few years ago in 2023, when a team of researchers successfully recorded the first ever confirmed video footage of a live one in the Cyclops Mountains region of northern New Guinea, pulling it out of the list of extinct species in the process. And to give you just a taste of how brutal the environment can be in New Guinea for these researchers, one of the expedition members fell through a moss pit into a previously unknown cave complex during the search and broke his arm in 2 places, but discovered 6 new species of blind harvest mice, spiders, and scorpions down there in the process. While another researcher reportedly had a leech stuck to his eyeball for 3 whole days. No thank you. But based on these 2 examples of large and previously believed extinct animals showing up again in New Guinea decades later in 2018 to 2023, there is a chance that others might be waiting to be rediscovered somewhere out there too. And none is a more tantalizing possibility than the thylacine, or commonly known as the Tasmanian tiger. The thylacine was a large carnivorous marsupial predator that served a similar ecological niche as canids like dogs and wolves did elsewhere on other continents, though they were completely biologically unrelated to them. They were among the largest carnivorous marsupials to ever exist, and they were most well known for their impressive ability to open their jaws to an unusual extent, up to about 80 degrees. The thylacine once had a range that spanned all across the ancient Sahul continent, when New Guinea and Australia were all connected. They're believed to have gone extinct in New Guinea and Australia around 3,200 years ago, at about the same time as the introduction of the dingo. But as the dingo never made it all the way down south to the island of Tasmania, the thylacine continued surviving there in robust numbers until the modern era of European colonization. The European settlers in Tasmania treated the thylacine as an unwanted pest that attacked their livestock. And so the government introduced a bounty hunting program on the species that rapidly eliminated their numbers and drove them into extinction. The last known living thylacine died in 1936 at the Hobart Zoo in Tasmania. And ever since then, no confirmed sighting of another one has ever been made, and the species was formally declared to be extinct decades ago in 1982. But nonetheless, because New Guinea is so massive, because it's such a hard place to properly explore due to the rainforests and mountains, because it's so rural and underdeveloped, because we know the thylacine's range once extended across the island, and because we have very recent examples like the Wandiwoi tree kangaroo and Edinburgh's long-beaked echidna turning back up alive there decades after they were declared to be extinct, there is a remote chance that if the thylacine was ever going to be rediscovered again, it would probably be somewhere hidden in New Guinea. And that is far from the only unknown thing on the island that could be hidden from us. New Guinea is, politically speaking, divided roughly in half today between Western New Guinea, under the control of Indonesia, and Papua New Guinea in the east, a separate and independent country. And Papua New Guinea is, bizarrely, the only country in the world today that has a completely unknown population. As in, nobody really knows how many people are actually living there. As of the country's most recent national census that was conducted in 2024, the official population stands at 10.18 million. But that census has been highly criticized as being inaccurate due to numerous issues that accompanied it, like incomplete coverage, missing forms, a warehouse containing material that caught on fire in the middle of it, and serious logistical problems with accessing some of the most remote population centers in the country. Only about 13% of Papua New Guinea's population are estimated to live in cities today, by far the lowest urbanization rate of any country today in the 21st century. Most of the country's population lives across the interior of the country in rugged, difficult-to-access areas that can often only be reached by airplane or helicopter, making conducting an accurate census probably harder than in any other country on the planet. The 2024 census and the last census before that in 2011 have both been widely criticized as being unreliable and inaccurate. And the last census they conducted that actually was considered to be reliable was all the way back in 2000, more than a quarter of a century ago now. And while the official 2024 census estimates the country's population at 10.18 million, a separate study conducted by the UN and funded by Australia in 2022 that based itself on satellite data and analysis concluded that the population was probably closer to around 17 million people in reality. A huge difference in the official census that possibly undercounted the population by nearly 6 million people. There's no conclusive agreement on any of these numbers, but it's absolutely mind-blowing to me that a country in the 21st century can still be potentially unaware of the existence of millions of people within its own territory. Like to the point where Papua New Guinea might not even be aware of the existence of about 40% of its actual population. Interestingly, there also appears to be a major difference in population between the eastern and western halves of the island. Papua New Guinea's population could be either about 10 or 17 million people today, depending on which study you want to use. While West New Guinea's officially cited population is only around 5.5 million, potentially less than a third of the population in the east, despite their areas being similar. And this can mostly be explained by the differences in the geography between the two halves. In more temperate parts of the world, population densities are usually higher in flat, lowland environments. But the opposite is most often the case in tropical parts of the world, where the lowlands are covered by dangerous, hostile rainforests, and where the mountains have more mild temperatures and less dangerous diseases and wildlife that allow for denser human habitation and agriculture. In the case of New Guinea, the mountainous highlands run across the entire island almost evenly from west to east, but their structure is very different on either side of the modern border. On the western Indonesian side, the mountains are very steep and almost immediately plunge down into the rainforest below, while the coasts are enveloped by dense mangrove swamps, an overall extremely difficult place to sustain large numbers of people in. In comparison, the mountains on the eastern side feature lower parallel ranges that contain a large agriculturally rich plateau between them that continues to be the most densely populated non-coastal part of the island. And unlike on the western side, the mountains on the eastern side actually reach all the way down to the coast and create natural coves that break through the otherwise omnipresent mangrove swamps everywhere else along the coasts, which in modern times enable the establishment of port cities like Port Moresby and Lae that continue to be the largest urban settlements on the island today. And part of why Papua New Guinea has very limited governmental authority anywhere beyond these cities, because getting anywhere else is just so damn difficult. Another factor that affects Papua New Guinea's ability to know how many people actually live within their borders is the sheer, almost unbelievable levels of linguistic and ethnic diversity that's present on the island. Across both sides of the island of New Guinea, more than 1,000 separate and individual languages are believed to still be spoken today, which is roughly 1 in 7 languages across the entire world. In Papua New Guinea alone, there are more than 840 languages spoken, and hardly any of them are even remotely related to any of the others, making Papua New Guinea by far the most linguistically diverse country in the world today, with nearly double the languages spoken in India despite its vastly smaller geographic size. The isolation in New Guinea created by all of the mountains and rainforests is so great that until fairly recently, some groups weren't even aware of the existence of neighboring groups who only lived a few kilometers away. Because of its harsh and fractured geography, the island has never in its history experienced the establishment of a strong, centralized authority, which in other parts of the world led to the dominance of a single language. And that's how you ended up with hundreds and hundreds of different isolated groups who developed their own independent languages in New Guinea over thousands of years. There are, technically, 2 lingua franca languages spoken in Papua New Guinea today, an English-based Creole language called Takbisin, and, to a lesser extent, an indigenous language called Hirimatu. But less than half of Papua New Guinea's population knows either of these lingua franca languages, making communication very difficult between certain groups even today. Now, on a slight tangent, Takbisin itself has a lot of extremely interesting grammar and vocabulary that it takes from English that I think is very interesting to share. Some of my favorite examples include "me love you" for "I love you," "time belong cold" for "winter," coming from "time belong cold," "asplus" for "place of origin," coming from "ass place," and "grass belong mouse," meaning mustache, coming from "grass belong mouth." For a long time, it was circulated in Western media that the Takbisin word for helicopter was "Mixmaster belong Jesus Christ," coming from "Mixmaster belong Jesus Christ," with the explanation supposedly being that the blades of a helicopter looked like the blades of a Mixmaster blender, and Jesus Christ went to heaven. So, therefore, the blender that rises up to heaven, or "Mixmaster belong Jesus Christ." But apparently, this specific term might have been a fabrication made up by visitors to Papua New Guinea back in the 1960s. And none of this is to even mention the numbers of tribes in New Guinea that continue to remain uncontacted today, with potentially still unknown languages of their own. It's believed that probably no longer any truly uncontacted tribes that exist in the more densely populated eastern side of the island in Papua New Guinea. But it is still believed that there are probably several uncontacted tribes who exist in the western side that's under the control of Indonesia. At the start of the 21st century, it was estimated by Survival International that there were still around 40 uncontacted tribes that existed across the remote rainforests of Western New Guinea, the second highest concentration of uncontacted peoples anywhere in the modern world, only behind the Amazon region of South America. However, after more than 25 years of the Indonesian government's activities in Western New Guinea and visits by missionaries, adventure tourists, and social media influencers, the numbers of uncontacted tribes still remaining today has been estimated by Survival to have declined down to only between 2 and 10, most of whom are aware of the outside world's existence, but have decided to keep their distance and remain separated. They are among the final ancient holdouts on the island resisting contact with the outside world, a process that has been ongoing for tens of thousands of years now. Archaeological evidence suggests that the first humans arrived in New Guinea as much as 60,000 years ago, during one of the very first human migrations out of Africa, making the indigenous Papuans among the most ancient people on the planet. Indigenous Papuans are loosely related to Aboriginal Australians, Melanesians, and other dark-skinned people found across the Asia-Pacific region. But interestingly, despite their similar-looking physical appearances, Indigenous Papuans are not closely related to Africans at all. In fact, Europeans are genetically closer to Africans than Papuans are. And a large part of that is due to the incredibly high concentration of Denisovan DNA that's present in Papuans. Denisovans were an ancient subspecies of humans that used to live across Asia tens of thousands of years ago. And the Papuans, for whatever reason, have the highest concentration of Denisovan ancestry out of any population in the world today. Their distant ancestors likely interbred with the Denisovans on their way to New Guinea. And after sea levels rose and isolated New Guinea from the rest of the world around 10 or 8,000 years ago, their genetics became even more isolated from the rest of the world, and so the Denisovan ancestry managed to stick around. Today, most Papuans share between 4 to 7% of their genome with the Denisovans. But there are some communities up in the New Guinea highlands who have upwards of 12% of their genome shared with them instead. By far the highest concentration known of any population in the world today. And despite the isolation of the Papuans in New Guinea after around 10,000 years ago when it became an island, they were capable of amazing and still puzzling things too. At Cuck Swamp, an archaeological site in Papua New Guinea, evidence has shown that the Papuans independently developed agriculture on their own without any outside influence sometime around 8,000 years ago, making them one of the very few societies on the planet to have independently developed agriculture and domesticated plants. The Papuans were likely the first people to domesticate bananas, taro, and sugarcane, which later spread elsewhere in the world after a wave of Austronesian settlers began arriving in New Guinea around 3,000 years ago and initiated trade. The arrival of the Austronesians also introduced a new layer of linguistic diversity to New Guinea as well. Today, out of the around 1,000 languages that are spoken in New Guinea, between 200 and 300 of them are believed to be Austronesian, while the others are Papuan. Now, one of the most interesting agricultural mysteries of New Guinea is how exactly the sweet potato managed to arrive there. The sweet potato is originally from South America, but evidence appears to suggest that it arrived in New Guinea sometime during the 13th century, hundreds of years before Columbus ever arrived in the Americas and started the Columbian Exchange. The leading theory is that the Polynesians probably managed to establish contact with indigenous South Americans sometime between the 11th and 13th centuries, which led to the sweet potato spreading westward through trade until it eventually arrived in New Guinea and completely revolutionized everybody's life there. Because the sweet potato could be grown in the highland environments of New Guinea and because it could be used for pig fodder without the need for cooking it, Papuan societies in the highlands that adopted it were able to rapidly amass pigs and dramatically expand their own populations into large and complex societies in the process, which remained uncontacted from the outside world longer than any other major society on the planet did. The highlands of New Guinea are basically an island within an island, highly elevated mountains and plateaus where agriculture is possible and human life is comfortable, surrounded by dense, hostile rainforests and then the ocean. With knowledge of the island's actual interior any deeper than the immediate coastlines being at a minimum to Western science for centuries, it was long assumed by Westerners that the interior of New Guinea would have no large populations of people, and the highlands themselves remained completely unknown and uncharted to the Western world until very recently in the 1930s. To give some context as to how insane this is, Europeans managed to reach the South Pole in Antarctica decades before they ever managed to reach the highlands within the interior of New Guinea. Beginning in the 1930s, Westerners finally began using airplanes to take expeditions into the New Guinea interior, where they expected to find only sparse populations of people. Instead, to their utter surprise, they discovered a very densely populated society in the highlands that was probably home to around 1 million people, marking the last major first contact between two large societies in human history. The Europeans were flabbergasted to have discovered a large Stone Age civilization that was still thriving so late into the 20th century. But many of the photographs taken by these first Western visitors to the highlands also capture the even greater feelings of shock on the faces of the indigenous Papuans, who had literally only known their own ancient society in the highlands just as it had been for thousands of years, and then suddenly got introduced to white people, airplanes, firearms, and even metal tools for the first time in their lives. It is a testament to how hugely isolated New Guinea really was, and to an extent, still is. And among the other greatest mysteries surrounding the island and its isolation is how the son of one of the wealthiest people in the world managed to just completely vanish there. In the early 1960s, Michael Rockefeller was the young 23-year-old son of Nelson Rockefeller, who was then serving as the governor of New York, and he was the great-grandson of Standard Oil co-founder and richest man to have ever lived, John D. Rockefeller. Michael Rockefeller was deeply interested in anthropology, and his father had just opened the Museum of Primitive Art in Manhattan and had appointed him to the museum's board. Wanting to find a statement piece for the museum's collection, Michael wanted to curate a collection of art directly from the source itself. And so, he decided to conduct an expedition to visit the Azmat people in what was then still Dutch New Guinea. The Azmat had only just started becoming pacified by the Dutch government and missionaries in the mid-1950s. And even by the 1960s, many of them had never seen a white person before in their lives. While headhunting, cannibalism, and cross-village warfare were still fairly common practices. Michael spent months interacting with the Azmat in 1961, and in November of that year, he, along with three companions, were sailing a small catamaran down the Azmat coast attempting to conduct trade. Then, one night, as they crossed the mouth of the Betsy River, harsh waters managed to flip and capsize their boat, leaving them all stuck. Two indigenous Azmat teenagers on board who had been brought along as guides almost immediately jumped into the water and swam for the shore, and eventually made it up to the village of Agates hours later where they were able to call for help. Michael and his other companion on board the catamaran, Dutch anthropologist René Wassing, were left clinging to the overturned boat for hours as they slowly drifted away from the shoreline. According to Wassing, after waiting around for a while and growing increasingly concerned that they would drift out into the open ocean, Michael decided to strip down to his underwear and tie two empty jerry cans around his waist for buoyancy, told him he thought he could make it to the shore, and then jumped into the ocean to attempt to swim around 8 a.m. in the morning, which at the time was probably around 12 nautical miles away from them. It was the last time that anybody would ever see any trace of him. And tragically, an airplane spotted Wassing still stranded on the boat just hours later after Michael had left, and he was quickly rescued just the following morning. A massive search and rescue effort that involved hundreds of people, airplanes, helicopters, and ships was launched for Michael across the area where he disappeared, seeing as how he was the son of the governor of New York and a member of one of America's wealthiest and most prominent families. But after 2 weeks of searching, no trace of him was ever found, and the search was officially called off. The Dutch colonial government that was still in control of Western New Guinea at this time officially concluded that Michael had drowned during his swim to the shore. But there is a significant amount of evidence and speculation that he actually met a far, far more gruesome fate instead. Headhunting, cannibalism, and tribal warfare were all still common practices amongst the Azmat at this time. And two Dutch missionaries who were fluent in the local indigenous languages and who had been living in the Azmat area for years steadily accumulated a trove of testimony from witnesses that directly contradicted the official Dutch government report. According to their own reports, a small group of Azmat warriors were walking along the beach that very morning when they just happened to encounter Michael Rockefeller after he swam ashore. It's important to know that a few years previously, a Dutch colonial raid in a village nearby had resulted in the killings of five important Azmat warriors, a transgression that the Azmat historically resolved through eye-for-an-eye killings and blood debts. So, upon their happenstance encounter with Michael that morning, a white man who looked like the white men who had killed their tribe members a few years previously, the group of warriors allegedly had an argument as to whether or not to kill him in vengeance, until one of them just stabbed him in the ribs and began killing him. Then, they allegedly took his body back to their camp, where they cooked and ate his flesh and brains in a ritualistic cannibal ceremony that was common for these kinds of vengeance killings at the time. Locals allegedly confessed these details to both of the Dutch missionaries a few weeks afterward and revealed that they had distributed his head, bones, ribs, and glasses amongst more than a dozen other people. both missionaries had sent their reports to the Dutch colonial government, while another Dutch colonial investigation into the disappearance the next year in 1962 came to the same conclusion as the missionaries had, that he was probably killed and eaten instead of drowning. Nonetheless, this information was deemed by the Dutch colonial government at the time to be highly politically sensitive, as they were attempting to still hang on to their colonial possession in New Guinea at the time and were incentivized to present their administration there as being stable and peaceful. And the potential killing and cannibalization of the son of New York's governor in their territory was anything but a good look for them. So the government officially concluded that he had drowned instead, while multiple independent investigations since then have seemed to indicate that he was brutally killed and eaten instead. Then, decades after his disappearance, the story took another bizarre turn in 2015. Documentary filmmakers who were working on a film about Michael's disappearance were sifting through a small collection of uncut film reels in a warehouse in New England that had been filmed in the Asmat region of New Guinea back in 1969 by a photographer who was investigating Michael's disappearance at the time, just 8 years after he had vanished. These uncut film reels apparently sat for more than 40 years collecting dust in that warehouse. But upon studying the reel in 2015, the documentary filmmakers discovered something astonishing that had apparently been overlooked by the people who had originally filmed it. A very brief clip of a group of Asmat tribesmen paddling a war canoe with a very conspicuous-looking white man paddling alongside them. The man bears at least some passing resemblance to Michael Rockefeller, and since it was captured just 8 years after his disappearance in this same area, it's led to a lot of renewed speculation that rather than drowning or getting killed and eaten, he may have also joined the tribe and integrated with them and was never heard from again that way. And even if this man in this photo isn't Michael Rockefeller in 1969, then who the hell is he? Nobody has yet been able to figure it out. And regardless of what actually happened to him, the vanishing of Michael Rockefeller and his ultimate fate remains one of the most enigmatic mysteries of New Guinea. And conclusive proof, one way or the other, is somewhere out there, still hidden from us. I also think it's important to clarify that cannibalism and headhunting have continued disappearing from New Guinea society since that time, and since the 1970s and 80s, have been practically non-existent and eradicated. Now, in the modern day, possibly the biggest thing that's hidden from view in New Guinea is one of the world's most dramatic ongoing conflicts that was just starting to begin as Michael Rockefeller vanished. You see, the Dutch still controlled Western New Guinea at that time, but they were about to transfer the territory over to Indonesia, which has been outrageously controversial ever since. Back in 1949, a few years after the end of the Second World War, the Netherlands finally agreed to recognize Indonesia's sovereignty over all of the territories that had used to belong to the colonial Dutch East Indies, but with the exception of Western New Guinea, which the Dutch decided to continue hanging on to for just a bit longer. The Dutch government argued that the indigenous Papuans were too ethnically distinct from the rest of Indonesia to be included in the same country, so they would continue administering it themselves until it was determined that the Papuans could sufficiently take over and govern themselves. The Indonesians, however, never accepted this. They argued that they were the legal successor state of the whole Dutch East Indies, which included Western New Guinea, and so they continued demanding a complete end to Dutch colonial rule throughout the entire archipelago. Both sides were also inherently interested in Western New Guinea's abundant mineral resources, especially what at the time was the recently discovered and then untapped Grasberg mine nearby to the summit of Puncak Jaya, which was already understood back then to contain an enormous amount of copper, gold, and silver. For years, neither the Indonesians nor the Dutch budged on their positions regarding the issue, and in the early 1960s, Indonesia began turning to the Soviets for support and began buying up Soviet weaponry. So then, alarmed at the potential spread of Soviet influence in Indonesia, the US began applying pressure on the Dutch government to give up and surrender Western New Guinea to them, which is the political context that Michael Rockefeller vanished into in 1961. And why it was especially awkward for the Dutch, who were desperate at the time to keep the Americans on their side in this greater overall dispute. In the end, it didn't matter though. The US wanted Indonesia on their side in the Cold War in Southeast Asia no matter what, and the only way they could do that was by continuing to pressure the Netherlands into surrendering West New Guinea to them. So, in 1962, the Dutch agree to transfer West New Guinea to a temporary UN administration under the promise that a plebiscite would be held in the territory to determine its ultimate fate. The Indonesian military moved into West New Guinea and then organized this vote in 1969, but they only allowed 1,025 specific hand-picked people to vote in the decision. Less than 1% of the territory's eligible voters at the time, and they were all made to vote effectively at gunpoint in the presence of the army. So naturally, the vote was in favor of union with Indonesia, and its legitimacy has been hotly disputed by West Papuan independence activists ever since. Indonesia moved in to formally annex West New Guinea, and an armed pro-independence insurgency formed to resist their rule called the Free Papua Movement, or the OPM. Indonesia's response to the OPM insurgency in West New Guinea since the early 1970s has historically been brutal and relentless, transforming the territory into what many independent analysts have described as effectively an authoritarian police state. Peaceful political expression and independence advocacy among indigenous Papuans is still illegal and harshly repressed by the Indonesian state. Even raising the Morning Star flag in the territory, the symbol of the Free Papua Movement, is legally regarded by the Indonesian state as an act of treason and can theoretically be punished by up to decades in prison. For decades, Indonesia has also strictly controlled access to West New Guinea, blocking reporters, journalists, NGOs, and even UN officials and others from any visits to the territory, which has obscured Indonesia's practices and repression going on there, and have also complicated scientific expeditions to the western side of New Guinea that are frequently denied access, leaving much of Western New Guinea as a sort of information black hole on the world map. Since the conflict began in the early 1970s, credible reports of mass killings and forced displacements of indigenous Papuans by the Indonesian authorities have been frequent and extensive. Scholarly research by the University of the South Pacific in 2007 concluded that as many as 300,000 indigenous Papuans have been killed by the Indonesian authorities since the occupation of West New Guinea began, while a report by the Yale Law School back in 2004 argued that Indonesia's actions there amounted to the definition of genocide. In addition to the harsh repression and violence, the Indonesian state has attempted to reinforce their demographic control in the territory by encouraging a massive settlement program that they've called transmigration, which is aimed at resettling landless Indonesians from crowded urban environments in Java, Sumatra, and Sulawesi to West New Guinea and giving them land that's been taken from the indigenous Papuans. As many as 300,000 Indonesian settlers were relocated to West New Guinea under this program following Indonesia's takeover of the territory. And today, it's believed that about half of the inhabitants in West New Guinea are either settlers themselves or the descendants of settlers. The OPM, largely armed with nothing but bows and arrows, javelins, and old leftover outdated weaponry from the Dutch colonial era, have waged a low-level campaign of guerrilla resistance against the Indonesians in West New Guinea for decades now, attacking critical infrastructure like roads and highways and, most importantly of all, the Grasberg mine, which, as it turned out, was among the largest copper and gold mines ever discovered anywhere in the world, that helped make the Indonesians rich as they began exporting New Guinea's minerals all around the world. And why a lot of outside countries effectively turn a blind eye to Indonesia's treatment of the indigenous population. In 2018, after the OPM launched attacks on an important road that the Indonesians were paving across the territory, the Indonesian army launched its largest military operation in decades against them, including massive air raids, the deployments of thousands of additional soldiers, and even the alleged usage of chemical weapons. All with unclear, but certainly high fatalities. As recently as 2022, the UN has condemned Indonesia's practices in West New Guinea, and some have even called for the deployment of a peacekeeping force to the territory to enforce order. But regardless, due to Indonesia's refusal to allow hardly anybody into the territory ever, and because of the outside world's reliance on all of the gold, copper, and timber that the Indonesians are taking and exporting from West New Guinea, there's very little prospect of anybody ever actually showing up to help the indigenous Papuans west of the border. And so many of them have viewed continuing militant and guerrilla activity as their only effective means of resistance. The conflict briefly captured the world's attention in February of 2023, when the OPM attacked a small airplane that had landed near their territory that was piloted by a New Zealand man named Philip Mark Meredens. They took Meredens as a hostage, threatened the Indonesian government that they would kill him unless they granted West New Guinea its independence. This all led to an intense standoff between the OPM and Indonesia. And because the hostage was a New Zealander, it briefly brought outside attention to the reality of the horrors that were and still are taking place in West New Guinea. Eventually, after more than 19 months of holding him, the OPM agreed to release Meredens alive, and Western attention towards the conflict in West New Guinea has gradually waned, though Indonesia's continued restrictions and repression in the territory continue unabated. And accurate information about what's actually going on the ground down there is still difficult, if not impossible, to actually come by. Now, there's a lot of data that goes into producing these kinds of videos. Whether it's visually showing you the scale of New Guinea compared to Greenland, detailing out how the glaciers on New Guinea have shrunk over time, or showing you how geography influenced the population being larger on the eastern side of the island than the western side, the ability to actually visualize raw data like this on the map instead of just reading about it in text format is exactly what makes learning about these kinds of complicated geographic subjects so fascinating to me. And it's why the Exploring Data Visually course is one of my favorite courses that I've ever taken with this video sponsor, Brilliant. They start out by teaching some real bare-bones fundamentals through interactive exercise and straightforward explanations. Then as you progress, they bring these small concepts together into the bigger process, and soon enough, you have a decent grasp of what originally seemed like a daunting subject. And the same goes for all of the other subjects they cover too, from calculus to AI to computer science, advanced physics, geometry, and much more. I think that Brilliant is perfect for the kind of person who genuinely loves understanding new things, as they get you up to the level where you can apply the concepts you learn into your everyday life. And they also make learning super practical. Their courses break down into short segments of about 15 minutes. So you can easily use their app to make steady progress in learning while you're commuting or whenever you have some free time. So, if you're the type of person who loves learning new things, or you want to get more serious about learning something new for the new year, you can try out everything Brilliant has to offer for free for a full 30 days by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by visiting brilliant.org/reallifelore, or by clicking the link that's down below in the description. And best of all, you'll also get 20% off of an annual premium subscription. It's an incredible way to help support my channel and learn some cool new things at the same time. And as always, thank you so much for watching.